All right, our agenda for today is here. On the agenda today, we've got an update on the face-to-face meeting at the Internet Identity Workshop in October out in Silicon Valley. We have some updates on the revised draft charter. So we changed a number of things to try and align expectations from W3C management and Microsoft input. We're working on Google, or rather, Shane's working on Google as we speak. There was some discussion on IPFS and how that fits in with WebDHT and verifiable claims, so we should spend some time today on the call to go over that. We have a new participant in the group that's joining us for the first time today, Bob Burke from Coupon Media. We had a really nice meeting with Bob out in San Jose last week around verifiable claims and the retail space. So we're going to get to a quick intro to Bob at the beginning of the call. Any other updates or changes to the agenda? Anyone else have anything to discuss that's new that's happened over the last 2 weeks?
Only that Adrian Gropper has joined the call. Thank you, Mara, for inviting me.
Oh, wonderful. Adrian, we'll also want to do an introduction to you after we do Bob's introduction. So think about, you know, three or four sentences that you'd like to say about the work that you're doing and your general interest in the verifiable claims area. That would be helpful. Any other updates or changes to the agenda? All right, let's go ahead and dive in with an introduction to Bob Burke, Coupon Media. Bob, go ahead.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone, and I appreciate you all the work everyone's doing. My name is Bob Burke, CTO of Coupon Media. We've been in the retail space delivering digital offers for about five years now. We focus primarily in the C-store space, and my interest in verifiable claims is we think it's an opportunity to deliver be an important part of delivering a complete digital offer lifecycle through the mobile web experience, because we find that a lot of our clients, although they are interested in apps, there's a huge load on or drive towards the mobile web experience. So that's kind of why we're here.
Awesome. Thank you, Bob. Next up is Adrian Gropper. So introduction to Adrian Gropper.
Sure. I am a full-time volunteer CTO of a nonprofit called Patient Privacy Rights for the past 4 years or so. My focus is on self-sovereign technology for managing very private information. I am a long-time contributor to the user-managed authorization work that's done out of the Kantara group, and also helped start the Health Relationship Trust work group under the OpenID Foundation. These are all things that are obviously based on OpenID Connect and OAuth. And currently, I'm trying to put together a demo of how all these things, including verifiable claims, would fit together under the W3C community model.
Awesome. Thank you, Adrian. And welcome, Bob, and welcome, Adrian, to the group. Hopefully this is going to be very useful to the types of things that both of you are trying to do. All right, let's shift into the first topic on the agenda today, which is our face-to-face meeting planning. So we reached out to the folks that run the Internet Identity Workshop and had a really good conversation with them about potentially co-locating with the Internet Identity Workshop or getting space, you know, around those days at the Internet Identity Workshop, maybe before or tacked on to the end of the of IAW. Those discussions are still ongoing, but it's looking very much like we're going to meet in October or have our first face-to-face meeting in October. Here's a link to the Internet Identity Workshop for those that don't have it. Loosely, you know, just to recap, there is a meeting of the Rebooting Web of Trust workshop the previous week to the Internet Identity Workshop. So we think that it's going to be the Rebooting Web of Trust workshop and then possibly the Verifiable Claims face-to-face meeting and then the Internet Identity workshop. Or we'll take, so that would mean the Verifiable Claims meeting is sandwiched in the middle. Or we might move the Verifiable Claims meeting to the end of the Internet Identity Workshop and co-locate with them. We're still working through the details, but this is pretty much our only chance to meet this year and co-locate with a bunch of people that we want to co-locate with.
Can you say data menu instead of sandwich words, please?
I'm sorry, say that again, Richard.
Could you give actual dates instead of sandwich ingredients, please?
Sure. Let me see. It would be the 2016.
25 to 27 October for IIW. I'm not sure what the current plan is for the Web of Trust.
Right, so I think we're trying to do Rebooting Web of Trust 18th, 19th, 20th. So it would either be the 20th and the 21st, or the 21st and the 22nd, or the 27th and the 28th. So there are three choices there within a week of one another, pretty much. So I don't have exact dates yet, Richard, because we haven't nailed everything down. We have to coordinate with both Rebooting Web Trust and Internet Identity Workshop on this. And we're really trying hard to not lose too many people. I know that, you know, if we have it on the 27th and 28th, we lose Nate and we lose Richard and a couple other folks. I think Dave Crocker, we lose you the previous week. Is that right?
I'll miss all of this, unfortunately. I'll be leaving early for the MOG meeting. And anyhow, this all, so yeah, I'll miss everything.
All right. So we're just going to miss you regardless.
I might be able to remotely access, but I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. So, you know, those are the dates we're playing with right now. So 20th, 21st, or 21st, 22nd, or 27th, 28th. And then Greg's a plus one on the end of IIW. I think regardless, you know, if we don't co-locate with IIW, there will be a big session on verifiable claims at IIW that, you know, the stragglers from the previous week will put on. All right. Any other questions on face-to-face planning?
It's Tim Holborn. I was just looking at the IIW proposed topics. Apart from the more centralized versions, the alternative appears to be blockchain or biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
And so that seems more about protecting the concept of self-sovereign identity via computational horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some of the credentials work around WebDHT, and certainly the IPFS type stuff looks like it's more of a social mechanism rather than a computationally protected mechanism. I'm wondering whether or not that distinction is what we're going to do around putting forward that distinction between.
We have discussed it in the past, and that is the third agenda topic today, is to talk about that distinction. So we will definitely get to that in the agenda today.
Thank you.
Okay. Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I was just going to say it. I mean, I guess people are probably coming from out of town for both Rebooting Web of Trust and IAW. Some subset of them will do both, but probably more people are coming to IAW. And if we want to encourage participation, tacking on IAW might get, at least for the first day, if the 27th, which people would plan to be here for anyway, might encourage more adoption for people such as that. And I am myself not available at all in the rebooting Web of Trust week.
Okay. All right. Good to know. So unfortunately, which is always the case, we're going to lose key people with any dates that we pick, unfortunately. Okay. Anything else on IAW in the face-to-face meeting before we move on? The other thing, sorry, one more thing I forgot to mention. We're looking for folks to put in some money to help sponsor food and stuff like that for people, and we may need, you know, money for a venue. My hope is that SpecOps might put some of that money in, and we're also looking for other organizations to put some money in for the face-to-face. Again, because we're co-locating, it's not going to be that expensive. We're talking about a couple of $1,000s, but it's money that we need folks to contribute if you have the means to do so. So please think about that as well. All right, next up, verifiable claims draft charter. So Wendy Seltzer from the W3C management team got back to us with a list of things that she wanted to see changed or addressed. We have responded to every single thing that she asked for and have made concessions in the charter without hopefully violating what we're trying to accomplish here. So I've just put the link to the charter in the IRC channel. We sent that out last Tuesday. We sent that out actually the week before, I think maybe on the Friday or the weekend. So it's been about a week and 3 days, 4 days. We haven't had a response back yet. The other thing to note is that, you know, Microsoft had said that they're going to take a look at it and get back to us, but they haven't gotten back to us yet either, so we're going to ping them again. So we're basically, you know, in a holding pattern again, waiting for feedback from W3C management and Microsoft. And, you know, hopefully, Shane, when you talk with Google, you'll be able to pass this stuff by them as well. To review the changes very quickly, here's a diff-marked copy. So I'm going to drop a link in the IRC. The diff-marked copy contains the changes that we have made. So the first set of changes that Wendy asked for was, she said that the main feedback she had was around the scope. She didn't want the scope to get out of control. And because of that, you know, we were talking about transacting in the charter, but we were not delivering anything that covers transactions, meaning we're not talking about a protocol like OpenID Connect or, you know, OAuth or anything like that. And so she said it's out of place to say that you're going to, that you're going to solve this transmission problem when you're not going to work on anything. And in the worst case, the group might then believe that it's chartered to work on a protocol when it's not. So we've struck words like transmit and transact and replaced them with words like express or machine readable, data format to make it more clear that we're not proposing a protocol to move this stuff around yet, right? Certainly not in this first iteration of the working group. Moving down to the problem statement, so let me get a link to that. Moving down to the problem statement here, she said that, you know, we can't presume that whatever we do is going to be widely used. We can't promise that. And then again, you'll see transacting and transmitting have been struck out. And the other chunk there in yellow towards the bottom of the problem statement is the biggest change to the charter. There are two competing things that we're trying to reconcile, conflicting things that we're trying to reconcile. There is a general desire from the credentials community group and the verifiable claims task force, and this has happened over the last, you know, four and specifically in the last 2 years, to identify a fairly broad problem, right? So we have gone to great lengths to get consensus around what the problem statement is. The issue with putting that problem statement into this document, though, is that at least that Wendy and I think Microsoft found issue with was that it made it seem as if we're going to try and solve that entire problem statement in the first cut. And that's what that's the concern they had. So this yellow text at the bottom clarifies that the problem statement provides a motivation for the work. We're explaining what the issue is. But we're also saying, look, the scope of what we're proposing in this working group is much more narrow, right? So the things, and then we go and we list all the things that are out of scope. So we're not going to do a new transaction protocol for verifiable claims. That's out of scope. We're acknowledging that the creation of a self-sovereign ecosystem requires more infrastructure than what's going to be developed during the charter. So that's out of scope, right? And then they wanted to see us focusing on use cases that had participants in the group. So, for example, they didn't want to get in the position where we were saying we're going to come up with a verifiable claims ecosystem for all industries. Because if, for example, the automotive industry doesn't join the group, we can't say that we have the right people in the room to come up with something that would work for them in the working group. So basically what this is saying is, you know, we're going to focus on use cases for people that are in the working group. Right now, it's education and payments industries, right? It's retail payments, it's education. Those are the people in the room. So that's again a scope limit. Clearly, everyone in the group wants to come up with a generalized solution that is going to work for other industries, but we can't insist that what we're going to come up with is going to work for those industries if those industries don't participate in the work. The other thing that we did, though, to prevent kind of an over-narrowing of the work is the final thing we say there is that, you know, while we're saying the scope is narrow for this work, the working group, once it's created, should not prevent the broader problem from being solved, right? So, you know, focus on the narrow scope, but keep the broader scope in mind or the broader problem in mind. Let me stop there and see if there's any input on this addition to the problem statement and see, you know, gauge the temperature in the room. Are people okay with this change? Do they feel it goes too far? Any thoughts?
Tim Holman. What happens if through the development of the work and the momentum is gathered and perhaps new stakeholders and new industries that we haven't formally been that haven't formally been encapsulated into the scope of work become interested? How are we able to amend the scope of work, you know, pending some sort of trigger that says if X parties, you know, within a vertical that we're not considering want to get involved, then we can amend it, you know?
Yeah, so there's the third, yeah, absolutely, I understand what you're saying. So the third bullet item there says that the group will focus on working group participant use cases. It doesn't say anything about when those participants join the group, right? So my hope is that if someone joins halfway through, or if, for example, we get five companies from the automotive industry joining halfway through, then addressing their use cases should be in scope, as long as it doesn't derail the work and, you know, things of that nature. So I think that that's
do we need to do we need to add something about onboarding so that way that opportunity is made clear?
It's a good question. I don't know. So let's hear from some of the other folks in the group and see what they think about that. Adrian Gropper, you're on the queue.
Yes, I think we are not saying enough about what self-sovereignty
means relative to the participants and the scope. And so, for example, when you say education and payments, when you focus it narrow to education and payments as opposed to healthcare, for example, we're losing the concept that professional societies that represent, say, doctors or lawyers or individual patients in the sense of patient privacy rights representing the interest of both of these groups are deeply, much more deeply interested in self-sovereignty than any industrial participant in this work. I think that we don't want to lose the focus on self-sovereignty as the essential thing, and therefore we can't just focus on industrial contributors out of, say, education, institutional contributors out of education or automotive, but rather have to deal with that issue.
Thank you, Adrian. Dave Crocker, you're on the queue.
Hi. The obvious danger of working on changing the targets when somebody new shows up is that it can destabilize the process. It can also be a non-terminating process as more and more people join. The usual way of dealing with new people joining is to try to educate them offline so they don't disrupt the main flow. To the extent that new people come in and have goals that are substantially different from the ones that are already being addressed, and then it makes sense to stop and say, is this a good time to stop and change, or can we continue down the path we're doing and expand the goals later? And so this difference between reorienting goals versus expanding goals becomes a really important point. If there is a sense that the current goals have a reasonable degree of a core benefit, then it will typically be true that when somebody new comes in, what they're going to be doing is adding things they want rather than changing what they want, or rather asking for changes. They will be asking for additions. Usually, and hopefully in this case, you can defer adding things, and what this does is to build up a wish list for version 2.
Right. So two pieces of information that might be useful to folks on the call. Adrian and Tim, I mean, usually the way this happens is that, you know, large industry participants tend to drive the work at W3C, right? So there is a disconnect from, you know, kind of this, I have observed the disconnect from what, you know, is good for society and what the industry participants want to accomplish. And usually when those things collide, it's the industry participants that almost always win out. It's the organizations that are doing implementations that have massive numbers of people using their systems. Those are the ones that tend to win out. So there's a great example of this that's happening in the Web Payments Working Group right now. The Web Payments Community Group did a lot of work over 4 years to put specs into place and design an ecosystem. And that ecosystem is definitely not being implemented in the way that I think the community group would have wanted it to happen. And I think the people in this group, in the Credential CG and the Verifiable Claims Task Force, could potentially be in that same position. So, for example, if we say that self-sovereign is really, really important for us and we care about, you know, identifier portability, we say that we want to onboard new work as new participants come on, what might happen is we end up starting the work, and we will have two or three very large technology companies join that disagree with the general direction, right? And that there is very little that can be written in a charter to prevent large companies from jumping in and taking over the work at W3C. It's the nature of the beast. So, you know, Tim, can new participants coming in modify the work? As Dave Crocker said, you know, the tool that's usually used to do that is rechartering. You recharter the group with an expanded scope or something different. So typically when these charters are done, that's it. They're done, right? We have outlined our expectation in education and payments, and we don't have that many healthcare companies at the table now, and we don't have any, you know, nonprofits and NGOs talking about, you know, citizen rights. And unfortunately, I think that's where we are.
Look, I do understand. The charter currently goes out to 2018. And so the web develops very quickly. And I entirely agree with you that when large companies gain momentum and push the world in a particular direction, things can change very rapidly. And so therefore, I refer back to the onboarding suggestion. In trying to establish some sort of, you know, whilst a variety of opinions have been shared even simply on this call, I'm not sure if we're able to clearly provide some sort of indication to organisations who may be interested and then set some boundaries around how we engage them effectively to be able to, you know, bring that to the table, I guess.
If you can think of a sentence, Tim, if you can think of a sentence that we can put in the charter that expresses that, we should definitely consider it. My experience with charters is that it's very hard to write language like that. I think the general assumption is there are going to be a bunch of companies that end up joining the work, and you know whether or not they're in education and payments, right? So we need to be able to convey that they are welcome in some way.
They may also be public institutions such as government. I think there's a variety of stakeholders who can be positively impacted by these works over time, and I think that the scope of this working group between October to 2018 is a fair chunk of time, and a lot can happen in that time. And so just locking in the stakeholders now and, you know, maintaining it, you know, what could be perceived in a year's time to be a less than ideal, you know, narrow-form scope without the means to be able to scale, would be unfortunate.
Right. In my opinion. So I'm hearing
also,
from both
and
you.
Also,
go ahead.
Sorry, and lastly, with regard to self-sovereign identifiers, I've raised some of my verifiable claims is very much about what an organization says about you. The idea that you have an identity on the web is a separate issue. And whilst some of the earlier credential CG sort of work around web DHT and things like that did try to attend to those sorts of issues, the way in which that the scope has changed, I have concerns about. I understand the merits, and I'm heart and soul very much a, you know, believer and, you know, work very hard towards the idea of a human-centric web. But I do have concerns about the terminology of self-sovereign as opposed to how verifiable claims works into an environment that sort of is representative of what might become a digital Magna Carta or, you know, something along those lines as Tim Berners-Lee has been promoting over the years. And I see that it's quite a separate issue. Within that, I also believe that there's an opportunity for the Credential CG, perhaps collaborating with other community groups, such as the WebID community group, to sort of incubate some ideas that may not fit into the charter of any interest group or working group, but can still be incubated within the community groups. And I do see that as a very separate thing to how organisations may engage any working group charter, you know, to progress what's ready, if that makes sense.
I think so. I'm So let's take the definition discussion and move it to later in the agenda, and focus this discussion on the charter. So I think what I'm hearing from both you and Adrian is that you're concerned that the charter is too limiting with respect to the use cases that we're outlining. So I think I'm hearing that correctly. Is that right, Tim and Adrian?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I would say that for now, for the status quo as it is today, is probably quite reasonable. But if this work continues to gain more momentum, then it may rapidly become out of date.
That's true. So what Dave Crocker said, I think, is important to note here, in that these organizations, when they see a charter go out, they want something locked in. They want something set in stone, and they don't want the scope to change. Because if the scope changes, that means that they may have to withdraw from the working group. So this has to do with, you know, patents and legal requirements and other W3C things. So let me restate this in a different way. A change in scope while the working group is operating is a big red flag to large organizations, and they tend to vote against charters that could have the scope change while the group is operating, right? So the point that you're making, Tim, is completely valid, but by even hinting that the scope could change, that will invite formal objections on the charter. Or my expectation is that, you know, that would change Microsoft from being okay with it to objecting because they don't know what they're signing up to in the charter.
I think that's a very fair concern. So I'll have a think about, you know, some level of compromise where the scope is locked in, but also there's a mechanism around the onboarding thing.
Yeah, that mechanism, again, that mechanism, Tim, is usually a rechartering. So if, for example, we have 10 healthcare companies and 10 automotive companies join the group, and they're concerned that we're not addressing their use cases, 20 companies is a good argument for rechartering the work and saying we have to take these use cases into account. Or as Dave Crocker said, version 2 has to include their concerns, and as a result, the active work that's going on right now cannot prevent version 2 from happening, or the version 2 that these new companies want from happening.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but again, cool. I think very valid points from both you and Adrian. And it would be great if you guys could think about some language that we could put in there that could summarize this very long discussion.
I'll do that over the week. Yeah. Cheers.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, any other questions on the problem statement or what's been changed there? That's the biggest change. The rest of the changes reflect that primary thing, that we're trying to be very clear about the scope. So in section 2, in the goals section, let me get a link to that for folks. So in the goals section here, we say that we're going to focus on claims with respect to the identified use cases, and we point off to our use cases document. We're saying the third goal is to ensure an interoperable standard that cuts across at least two industries, right? So we just said multiple industries. They said that was too broad. So we basically said at least two, because we want a solution that is cross-industry, and hopefully by focusing on two industries instead of just one, we're able to, you know, move towards that. But if we have, you know, three or four industries participate, that's fine, right? That's not out of scope. And again, the rest of it is kind of playing around with language, using the word broader instead of broad. Let's see. In section 3 scope, we made a change that tries to, again, refine. Oh, I'm sorry. Adrian, you're on the queue. Go ahead.
Do this with respect to industries, there's two kinds of industries out there. There's industries that are regulated significantly through licensed professionals. and industries that are regulated through corporate, you know, at the corporate level. And so I don't know if we can capture this aspect in the charter, because it's fundamental. A lot of, you might say, the entire reason for verifiable claims is to deal with regulatory practice. And if we don't recognize that some industries, like for instance healthcare, 99% of the money is spent not by a corporation but by a licensed professional, then I think we will get lost. You know, it might look like it works for payments. My experience with UMA, long experience with UMA, is that if you use education that way, you don't actually make a lot of progress in terms of dealing with the real issues, because education is very squishy. And payments, again, are very narrow and not privacy intensive. Or regulatory intensive. It's shallow. So I just want to, you know, point out that point about industrial perspective versus licensed professional as a regulatory foundation.
So I think in our use cases we make that distinction, and we point to the use cases from the charter. So we have a couple of medical. We have a number of medical use cases in here. So if you look at, let me find one for you. So 3-5 professional credentials. So Adrian, do you have access to, yeah, you do. So if you look here, Adrian, at Lincoln IRC, we talk about professional credentials and we specifically talk about doctors. I think, you know, it's certainly not out of scope, and we certainly point to use cases, medical use cases, in the use cases document. You used a phrase that sounds like we could easily put it into the charter. You made two classifications of the types of credentials, right? It's basically corporate credentials and licensing body credentials. So if you could think of some language that we could put into the charter, like take a look at the charter and figure out some language that we could use to put in there. The other thing that we could do is we could expand it from just education and payments to education, payments, and healthcare. The issue with that is that to date we have only had two healthcare companies that have said that we've only had one healthcare company say that they're interested in participating in the work. Adrian, you could be the second organization. But when W3C and Microsoft take a look at that, they don't see enough input from the industry, right? They want to see like five organizations participating before they feel safe saying that we're going to tackle the healthcare use cases. Okay, so that's statement one. I think everyone in the group agrees with you, or I would say the vast majority of the people in the group agree with you, right? The broader the ecosystems that we're looking at will result in a technology that can be used across all these market verticals, and we have to take those use cases into account when we build this technology. So Adrian, could you think about some wording that we could use in the charter to address those concerns that you have?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, awesome, thank you. Tim, you're on the queue.
Yeah, medical credentials are fairly high stakes. So mm-hmm. I would love to see a world where, you know, my grandfather's a pathologist and he had a camera on his microscope, I think in the 80s. I would love to see a world where there's signatures that are sent across the web to be able to analyze, you know, fluid or tissue samples for everything rather than one particular billing code. But it is particularly high-stakes data. And so maybe a possible alternative is civics. So whilst you're still dealing with, is there an alternative use case where you're still looking at the privacy-preserving You know, you're still looking at the sorts of things that you need within medicine, but you're not dealing with such high-stakes data where you really want to see the technology proven out very well before you deploy it in that use case specifically, subject to market alternatives, of course.
Right. So let me – so as far as use cases are concerned, we have – Section 3.6, where we talk about legal identity. Tim, this is, you know, these are some of the use cases that you've raised over the past couple of years. So I'll put a link there in IRC. And we talk about things like refugee crisis use cases. We talk about digital driving licenses. We do have some low stakes, you know, use cases in there. I don't know if that actually addresses your concern, though.
Well, I'm just thinking that rather than going straight, you know, healthcare is pretty serious. So if a hospital, you know, makes an unfortunate mistake in all sorts of different ways that may, you know, from my understanding, they've got pretty big legal departments. So, you know, to be able to go into that industry, you need to really have all your ducks in a row. Whereas the actual process and how to, and what you're trying to achieve technically, as to be able to example it in an industry where it is working, and it's, you know, it's less direct. So I mean, some of the refugee thing. There's other areas where I think that you've got a very similar sort of business system, but it's not as, you know, directly life threatening if there's a problem, you know, with the deployment. And I imagine it's going to take some time for these things to be picked up and well understood by the marketplace as a whole. Look, healthcare is, again, something else that's very dear to my heart. But I'm wondering whether or not we can achieve the same outcome by looking at a related sort of industry that's slightly lesser stakes.
Yeah, and there are, yeah. In all of these cases, I think there are use cases where it's not as high stakes, such as someone using, you know, basically pre-filling a medical form with a proof of residency, you know, proof of address credential, right? That's fairly low stakes. Or an education credential that just says that you've done a weekend programming course, right? Those are some examples of low-stakes use cases. So I think we have those. But if you look at the, you know, use cases that drive a lot of these large companies to want to use this stuff, they are the high-stakes use cases, right, where there's a lot of money on the line, there's a lot of risk on the line. And clearly, I think those organizations are going to go through a multi-year vetting process for this technology. And while those organizations are doing that, we can still test out the technology in more low-stakes settings. So I think, you know, the strategy is aligned with what you're suggesting, or our current strategy is aligned with what you're suggesting.
I think another one that was brought up was the idea of identifying whether or not an Uber driver has mm-hmm. appropriate credentials to mean that you want to jump into that car.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, it's something else I'll have a think about.
Okay. All right, so we've gone through the charter. Those are the major changes to the charter. Does anyone have any very strong feelings about the direction that we're headed in? Are there any objections to the changes that have been made? Do people feel that, we're making, you know, mistakes here? Clearly, we've heard from everyone on what the concerns are. Are there other concerns about changes to the draft charter? Does anyone feel like this is unworkable, does anyone feel that this is unworkable? They would not join the work if this charter went forward. Shane, you're on the queue.
Thank you. Sorry. It's not that I wouldn't join the work. You're jumping through a bunch of hoops here that somebody's held up for you. What do you think the odds are that the people who held the hoops up are entertained enough to actually let things happen?
So an excellent question, and I think that's the most important question, at this point. I think all we can do is do proper due diligence and act in good faith, right? At some point, it will become apparent that the people that are holding the hoops up had real concerns and they wanted the work to proceed as long as they felt safe about it, or they were just doing this for entertainment, right? So I don't think this is for entertainment. I think these organizations are intrigued enough to engage with us, and W3M is intrigued enough to engage with us, and the Web Payments IG, passed this stuff unanimously, meaning the people in the room at the time of the vote passed it unanimously. So, if it turns out that we make all of these concessions and the answer is still no, then the group always has the option to roll the concessions back and proceed through another group anyway, through another standardization body that does want this stuff to start more than W3C does. So I don't know what our odds are. I think we've done everything that we can to act in good faith, and now it's up to W3C management and Google and Microsoft to reciprocate that. David Chadwick, you're on the queue.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just to remind the group that we had discussions about privacy enhancing, what that meant, and it was agreed to add that to the definition section.
Excellent point. I'm sorry, that's on me. I forgot to do that. I will do that. There are a couple of other outstanding changes to the charter, I think, that still need to be made. So your terminology changes or additions absolutely need to be made. I think Dan Burnett raised a couple of typos that need to be fixed as well. So yes, David, but please ping me again and make sure that I get that in there. David
Ezell.
Okay, thank you. David Ezell, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to say it's actually a little stronger than just the people who were in the room for the IG. We sent out a follow-up email stating that there was two-week period at which people could disagree. Otherwise, it's assumed we have consensus of the IG. We did not get any rejection even from the companies who were expressing doubts, even though they are on the IG. So we got no knows, so it's more than just people in the room, it's the IG.
Great. Thank you, David. That is a very good clarification. Adrian, you're on the queue.
That comment about the privacy enhancing terminology makes me want to pile on with something that unfortunately is a much bigger topic, but should be at least outed. I spent 2+ years on the board and management council of the Identity Ecosystem Steering Group, and I assume that at least, I don't want to go into, again, we don't have time as to what that is, but it was a NIST attempt to introduce privacy-enhancing practices on a very large scale for cybersecurity reasons primarily. And I stepped off of that board. I was actually voted off by 2 to 3. My point being that the companies that we have here in W3C did not show up in IDESG. And the problem of the general problem of how to deal with cybersecurity issues all through the industry, and there's nothing healthcare specific about what we're doing, is really, in my opinion, an unsolved problem that Microsoft and Google and a lot of other corporations and institutions have not found a home for how to approach that. And all I'm saying is the experience we're having, whether it's my experience or you broaden it, with, I worked as a consultant for the Postal Service looking at Connect.gov in part, and the role of the Postal Service relative to cybersecurity issues. I don't think we have 5 years to do this work, to start slowly for 2 years in this community group and then see what happens 3 years after that, because we are failing, not just in the U.S., but globally, at doing the kind of work that we try to do in IDESG and so on. Anyway, thank you for letting me vent.
So, Adrian, hopefully it makes you feel better that we have, you know, the word privacy enhancing and privacy is riddled throughout the charter. It's a big concern for this group, so much so that we even have a section. We call it out specifically, section 3.2. Let me find it. If you look in the charter, scroll down to section 3.2, we have security and privacy considerations. It's a full section below the terminology section, where we call out privacy specifically and trying to improve upon it. So, you know, that's as much as we can do in a charter, right? We can't guarantee privacy. We can't guarantee the outcome, but we are saying it is very important, and we're going to keep an eye on it and design towards a privacy-preserving technology. And in addition to that, we are going to collaborate with other organizations like the Privacy Interest Group at W3C on ensuring that we are privacy enhancing as we build this technology out.
Yeah, I was trying to make a different point, a more subtle point. It's not about necessarily charter. It's about how to sell our charter to Microsoft and Google. That's all I was trying to say.
Are you saying if we focus on the privacy-enhancing stuff that will be more compelling to Microsoft and Google?
If we approach it from the cybersecurity perspective, it might be more appealing to Microsoft and Google.
Okay.
And in other words, the NIST in this process called IDESG, very much, you know, 5 years ago when they charted it, saw the link between privacy enhancing, which is clearly the new thing they brought to the table, and cybersecurity, which was the reason to try and convene this whole massive project. And what happened was that only minnows with specific, relatively narrow interests in identity management showed up to the table. And the Microsoft and Google were not there at any point. So what I'm trying to say is that we don't know enough about Microsoft's and Google's type interest in the cybersecurity aspect, how that relates to privacy-enhancing standards or policies, whichever you prefer. It's a governance problem that we're in a position to solve at W3C that is not being solved elsewhere.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Adrian. I don't know how to modify the charter to capture what you just said. So if you don't mind either following up on the list or, maybe writing a strategy email about how the group could react to what you said, that would be helpful, I think. I note that we have 3 minutes left. That is not going to be enough time to cover the IPFS and verifiable claims discussion, so we're going to have to roll that over into the other call. Really quickly, though, Tim's raised a bunch of great questions about IPFS. The group is aware of IPFS. We have looked fairly deeply at IPFS. We know Juan Bennett and have worked with him at the Rebooting Web of Trust workshops and various other fora, and believe very deeply in the work that he's doing. A number of us do. It's all good stuff, but we don't think that IPFS is a solution for WebDHT or blockchain-based identifier, decentralized identifiers, primarily because IPFS does not have mirroring guarantees, right? You can lose information on IPFS if enough nodes don't keep it. So it's not a very good decentralized identifier mechanism. the group is looking at other blockchain-type mechanisms for decentralized identifiers and verifiable claims. There's that Flex Ledger work that's going on. There's the Sovereign work that Evernym's doing. I know there's Badge Chain also. So there are, we are aware of IPFS. We don't think it's a solution for some of the things, but as Kerry pointed out in the IRC channel, you can store some data in IPFS, right? But you can give no guarantees about the data that's stored there. So for decentralized identifiers, it's not a good solution. For pseudo-anonymous batch data, it's a pretty decent solution, right, if you don't need that data to stick around forever. And so, you know, verifiable claims, you know, how does this fit in with verifiable claims? Well, you know, just like batch data, you can store verifiable claims in any one of these locations. You can store a hash of it in a blockchain, or if it's like a Flex Ledger blockchain, you can store the data itself in the blockchain as long as it doesn't contain PII. You can store verifiable claims in IPFS because, again, a verifiable claim is just a document. And a variety of different other storage mechanisms, you know, Amazon S3, all that kind of stuff. So IPFS is complementary, but we don't think it's a replacement for some of the DID stuff. And we can dive into that a bit more next week. Tim, was that in general what you were going after in your questioning on the mailing list?
Well, as I've just posted into the IRC channel, I asked Vince, I know Vince Cerf has been working on the interplanetary internet system. And so I asked him today, and his response was, I'm in contact with the IPFS folk with regard to digital archiving and preservation. So what I'm interested in trying to figure out how and if we can support a more cooperative or collaborative approach to accelerating, you know, the delivery of an alternative to blockchain, which I believe is computationally flawed from a security point of view, is an alternative where working with the LDP type of solutions, we're able to look at how to create human-centric identifiers. And so WebDHT, from my understanding, did a lot of that, but that's been put to one side, and there's a resourcing issue. And so given that Vint Cerf has said specifically that he's looking at it for preservation, wherever he's, I've posted exactly what he said in the list, maybe the way that we should be following that up, directly or indirectly via the CG or however the mechanism might be.
Right. Right. So it sounds like we need to have a discussion in the group, again, around blockchain, IPFS, and some of these newer technologies and how verifiable claims kind of fits into that story. Okay, so we'll put that on the agenda for next time. We're out of time. We're 2 minutes over. Sorry for that. Thank you, everyone, for the call today. We may not have another call next week, primarily because we're just kind of in a holding pattern with W3C management on the charter, but expect a call the week after that. Okay, thanks everyone for the call. Have a great rest of the week. Talk to everyone in 2 weeks. Bye.